Welcome to the Political Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Bockle. The episode you're about to listen to is an interview with Philip Pettit on his latest book, The State. Apologies for long-time listeners. It's been a little while, about 6 months since I released an episode. Few reasons for that podcasting sabbatical. I've had quite a lot going on in my life that I won't bore you with. But essentially, I always just think it's better to take a little bit of a break from content creation than it is to put out something that you're not happy with and isn't worth the audience's time. But I have recorded some new interviews that I'll be getting out, and the guests are great, and I'm really pleased to bring you. And I've also got some plans for some solo content scripted out that should be coming eventually. So apologies for this brief break. It's good to be back with you. For Patreons and people who sponsor the show, that's done on a per episode basis. So if I don't put out content, you don't get charged, which I think is fair enough. So that all to one side, let's get straight to today's episode, who, if you've been following the show from the beginning, will be very familiar to you. Philip Pettit is the L.S. Rockefeller University Professor of Human Values at Princeton University and Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the Australian National University, Canberra. And he's the author of a number of books, including Republicanism, On the People's Terms, Just Freedom, so on and so forth. He's most known for a Republican or a neo-Republican theory of the state, theory of freedom. It's something that if you've followed my work on freedom, including my book on freedom, his name will show up in a lot of that. I won't preface this episode with much. I think the conversation pretty much speaks for itself, and we set up the topics as we go. The book, when it was announced, was subject to some controversy and some critiques on Twitter when it came out. So I started with that. I let Professor Pettit respond, but then we more or less just went through the thesis of the work, and, you know, I gave my thoughts as we went. And, you know, to sort of discuss them where we agreed, disagreed, and so on. So I really enjoyed having Philip back on. I hope you enjoy this conversation too. And yeah, it's good to be back. This is The State with Philip Pettit. So, I am joined today by Professor Philip Pettit. Philip, welcome back to the podcast, friend of the podcast, for a third time now.
Thanks, Toby. I'm glad to be here.
how have you been keeping? It's been, what, a couple of years since our last one of these?
I guess so. I've been keeping quite well. Busy, too busy. I wish life were less full, but still. It's been enjoyable.
Cool. And in the meantime, thank you for helping with my book and contributing a chapter there.
I was to do that. Absolutely.
So we're going to do your latest, The State. What's your motivation to write this book? Because one, you're not on Twitter, are you? And you shouldn't be, because it's going downhill. But one pushback this got when the announcement came on Twitter, and we might be able to chalk this one up to just over-exuberant marketing, is the sort of tagline Princeton put out was, you know, the state has been ignored until now. And of course, people sort of responded of like, well, I'm not ignoring it. Look at my book here or my writing there.
But I figured that would be a good place to start, because I'm not attributing to you the view that no one has ever written on the state in political theory. But at the same time, presumably you thought there was some sort of a gap here, or some sort of area that needed further exploration, or you wouldn't have written the book, right? So what was that area that you felt wanted addressing?
Well, think about Herbert Hart on the law. I mean, he wrote that famous book in the 60s. Perhaps we'll come back to it, another connection on the concept of law. And he put in focus the question of what exactly is the law, and treated that question as different from the question of what would make laws good laws or just laws. Now, I think that in at least analytical political theory, but I also think to a good extent, for example, in the Frankfurt School type theory, the focus for 50 years really has been on what's required of the state in the matter of justice. For example, take the Rawls book, which really has shaped political philosophy for the last 40, 50 years, A Theory of Justice. I mean, he asks about what is required for justice, and there's this wonderfully imaginative and original theory has achieved and deserved great attention. But he looks at justice, he makes assumptions. He says the assumption about society is that it's a mutual venture. It's a collective venture for mutual benefit. And that's about all in that original book, in any case. He does develop much more about institutions in later work, but he doesn't look at, that's like asking the question, as we do in lots of areas, what is our goal? And then asking what is the best means whereby we might achieve that goal? And so Rawls tells us that the best means are the set of institutions that establish, satisfy his two principles of justice, one liberty principle, the other broadly an equality principle. And he does that without going into the detail about the institutions that might do this. I think that in the case of political philosophy, we've probably pushed that way of thinking too far, focusing on the goal and assuming the means can be adjusted to whatever the goal requires. Because thinking about the state, it's a sort of institution we've had with us for millennia. And it's a sort of institution with a many varieties, but a common character, you know, as many people have commented on over the ages, associated with law, associated with a claim of authority, and of course, territorial and always coercive. And that being the case, we, at least I assume, that the only means we can really use effectively to achieve any goal we might have in political theory, such as the goal of justice under this, that, or another theory, is going to be the state. And so we need to look, before we look at what the ideal means would be of achieving, so to speak, that goal, we need to look at, well, what is the institution, the means that we have available? Because whatever we do by way of achieving justice, it's got to be in some way using the state as it exists now. And so I felt we need a focus on exactly what is the nature of the state, the function of the state, what are its limitations, what are its potentialities, its possibilities. We need a view on that before we look at what might the state be, or should the state be, to achieve justice?
I mean, I think if you're taking Rawls as your baseline, it's definitely the case that whatever the merits, and there's nothing in the two principles I particularly find objectionable, but there's not a lot in Rawls that speaks to the reality of existing institutions. I mean, there's a little bit when you get to like law of peoples and stuff, but I think that's correctly regarded as not among his best work. Random aside, there's a line, it's one of my favourite lines in the history of political philosophy that Macaulay uses about James Stuart Mill, John Stuart Mill's father, which I think wonderfully encapsulates Rawls and speaks to whatever bit you're speaking of, in that James Mill does this treatise on government, which very elaborate thing from utilitarian principles and so on. And Macaulay, in a review, just demolishes it in a sentence. He says, and I quote, "Here we have an elaborate treatise on government from which, but for two or three passing allusions, it would not appear the author is aware that governments exist amongst men." And I've always sort of felt that that one line could also be quite effectively levelled at theory of justice.
Well, that's interesting, because I suppose, well, that's very nice of you. It creates an entree for what I'm attempting to do here, which is to look at the state. And if you think the state has a function and a nature, then that means that there are going to be limitations and there are going to be possibilities for using this institutional complex for the state. And there are going to be, as it were, functional requirements on the state if it's going to live up to its nature and its function. And what I've actually come to think, what I argue in the book, is that many of the requirements on the state, just by virtue of its function, and their requirements even on a state that's functional but not particularly just, for example, it might recognize everybody as a citizen, there are functional requirements on the state. And I think that many of these requirements turn out to be requirements that have more traditionally been argued for on the basis of the requirements of justice. For example, I think a state that's going to discharge its function, as I characterize it earlier on, ideally should be a state that, for example, incorporates a rule of law. And it should be a state that that lives up to some ideal, and there are many of those, I discuss them a bit in the book, of a checks and balances regime. And those are requirements, I think, on a functional state. And it's important that, you know, there are requirements of that kind, more basic requirements, in other words, than the requirements of justice, about which we're much more likely to quarrel as between different sides in politics. And that was one of the, for me, actually, one of the sort of discoveries in thinking about the nature of the state and its function and what would enable it to discharge that function and its limitations and so on. For me, that was something of a discovery that I thought you could argue, for example, for those requirements just on the basis of what's required to make the state functional in its own terms.
So there's two sides, yeah, I'll go with that, to the argument, in that we're doing both descriptive, is perhaps wrong, we're not just describing what states are, we're looking at some core, well, function, to use your language, but we're also pulling that through into normative arguments about what states ought to be or how states might be morally assessed as better or worse, but looking at the question of moral assessment through the lens of a function. Is that broadly right?
That is broadly right, but let me give you just an analogy, because this book is not a great original work, in my view. It may be addressing a topic that I feel has been insufficiently addressed. So, for example, one precedent, as it were, to the approach I take is in Ronald Dworkin, with whom, you know, the other fronts in which I disagree with Dworkin. But when Dworkin, for example, emphasizes that a way of approaching a theory, for example, of democracy, or it might be a theory of justice, is to say, let's look at actual democratic institutions. Let's see on the best interpretation, as he puts it, constructive interpretation. Let's see what goals they serve. And then, or if you like, in my language, what function they discharge, as he says, on the best interpretation. And then let's ask ourselves how it might be developed or reconstructed, shaped, changed in order better to discharge that function. I'm doing something a little bit like that. I have a different way of identifying the function, not by constructive interpretation, as he calls it, actual institutions, but by a genealogical approach, as I describe it, but it's not just my word. And then looking at, given the function of the state according to that genealogy, what is needed for the state best to discharge that function, and what limitations does that function place on it, if any?
Got it. I'm pleased you said, just to quote you back to yourself, it's not an especially original work. That would be kind of my review of it. Is a lot of it, I've read quite a few of your books at this point, is like, oh, okay, I know this bit. You know, like I've, with corporate agency, I'm sort of familiar with your arguments there, and I can sort of like, forgive me, but not read too hard because I already know you on this. And then with other bits, we're sort of almost just importing Hart or something like that, right? And then the value isn't, here's something that's like absolutely A to Z, never been done before. It's we're taking bits and pieces and putting them together in a more elegant and parsimonious way than perhaps they've been done before. And the value, so this is my book review, if you care, the value is more in the assembly of parts and the shaving off of rough edges, so you don't have to read all of Hart. We can say, okay, this is the bit that I want to plug between these gaps, right? And it's more like, if we're assessing, do we like this book or not? Well, you could ask whether you agree with it, but just like, is it a good work of philosophy? I would say it's more in like the assembling of parts rather than the parts. That's kind of my book review.
I see. Okay. Well, let's think about Hart, and maybe that would take us into the methodology of ascribing a function.
Or if you want to follow on from that, you can feel free to disagree with my review. But like, if you accept that sort of characterization of like you're pulling together a number of sort of different parts and trying to get it really neat, maybe you could talk about how you structured the book, because I think that is quite important to the argument.
Well, I would say I wouldn't describe the book as just putting together different parts that are independently familiar as much as pursuing this project as I see it. And of course, inevitably, I use arguments from other people, and I use arguments from my own work in earlier periods. For example, the argument about corporate agency that derives from the work I did with Christian List. That's hardly surprising, but the point of the book wasn't to put those parts together. It turned out that that was a byproduct of seeking the aim that I was pursuing. So maybe I should talk just a little bit about the method adopted in identifying the function of the state. I thought over this for a long time as to how you might best identify a function of the state, and I was very taken, I've been taken in other ways too, by what is sometimes now called a method of pragmatic genealogy, which was identified by Edward Craig in a book long ago on knowledge, the concept of knowledge, in the 1980s, early 90s perhaps, and taken up very much by Bernard Williams in his book on truth and truthfulness. And it struck me that this method they were describing, which I found very attractive independently, is actually a method that has been followed over ages, really, by political philosophy, but also other areas of philosophy. So one of the prime examples of the method, it seems to me, though neither Craig nor Williams referred to it, surprisingly, is Hart on Law, the concept of law in 1962. And equally, David Lewis on Convention, which was published in 1969. And so, for example, what each of them does is to ask, look, in order to identify what conventions are, our laws are, wouldn't it be a good idea to imagine a society without laws or without conventions? And then, well, let's take the convention case first, as Lewis does. Imagine people like us, you know, relatively rational, but you know, not amazingly sort of insightful or anything, in a world without conventions. Well, they'd lack a convention about which side of the road to drive on or ride on if you're on a horse or whatever, imagining an earlier society, or how to, you know, greet someone. You know, do you kiss them on both cheeks, on one cheek? Do you shake hands? You know, it's very awkward if, so to speak, people want to do the same thing in cases like that. And when they're not doing the same thing, they are involved in what Lewis calls a coordination predicament. And then he tells a story about how in such predicaments, creatures like us, relatively rational, would have resources by which to find solutions to these problems, resources by which to identify what they can each expect the other to do in this circumstance. So, for example, precedent or analogy might identify, you know, the sort of solution. In the case of greeting, it might well be that, you know, shaking hands emerges, you know, because that means you haven't a knife in your hand or whatever. I mean, that's one sort of just so story told about handshaking. Or, you know, that it might be associated with waving, maybe that existed previously. In any case, his story is that people would adjust by finding a solution to coordination predicament. It would become a regularity among people in a given community or society. It'd be recognized as a regularity, of course, by all of them. They'd all recognize that it is a regularity, recognize that everybody else recognizes it is a regularity. And then they would, of course, begin to use it to teach their children, you know, or to even teach newcomers, or maybe even to correct people. And at that point, you have a regularity that's established as a convention. Why is it a convention? Because it's a regularity such that everyone wants to conform to it if others are conforming to it. And now Lewis, of course, it's an as-if story, but Lewis is suggesting not just that it was possible that people in his counterfactual experiment would develop conventions, regularities of this kind. I think he's suggesting would be robustly possible, you know, not possible just by virtue of a fortuity, you know, or a lucky accident or whatever. You know, no matter what sorts of events were going on, they'd be likely to chance on something like this, and it'd be likely to spread and become a convention. And Hart, in the same way, he starts about with law. What is law? What's the function of law? Now, just going back to Lewis for a moment, if you ask Lewis, what's the function of conventions? Well, it's to solve coordination predicaments. That's what he's going to tell us. Maybe not everything we call a convention nowadays does satisfy that function, but that's a natural kind now of convention, maybe a subset of what we actually call conventions. And we can say of them that they really do serve this function and are an important social kind. Okay, why would he say that's the function? Well, the fact that they would have emerged, so to speak, in response to the need for people to get over coordination predicaments indicates that they had a real benefit for those people. That's now in the counterfactual model. And then it's just a hypothesis based on that model that, you know, perhaps that's the function they're serving for us. Perhaps that's why they're so stable. Hart, and I'll try to be briefer now, does a similar thing with laws. He presupposes that there are norms. Let's not talk about them for the moment, though. My book talks about why you would expect norms as well as conventions to emerge, informal, collectively beneficial norms governing how people treat one another. Hart assumes there are norms in question, and then he identifies various problems that people in a society without laws would face. And then he argues about how they would be very likely to adjust to these problems and how, as a result, the problems might be, for example, maybe a norm is unclear. maybe things have changed and it's no longer relevant. Like the norm might have been that you can throw your waste in the river and then someone starts mining upriver, you know? That's a changed circumstance. These people are going to want that norm to be changed in favor of another norm. Another problem might be that, well, someone breaks a norm and maybe they would be disesteemed for breaking the norm. That's penalty enough. But they deny that they broke the norm or they treated the victim, the complainant, in that way. Well, that's another problem. How are you going to determine? And Hart's view is that, you know, in a sort of, in a series of ad hoc adjustments by people, they'd be very likely to bring some sort of system into existence that would regulate the norms, establishing a way whereby the norms could be made clearer, more determinate, establishing a way whereby they can be changed if necessary. I mean, it might be by appealing to the wise old person. It might be by summoning a committee. It doesn't matter. It might be any of those ways. And similarly, a mode of identifying an offender and making sure that the offender doesn't offend again, you know, perhaps by punishment or whatever. And he says, look, what you have then is norms which are applied on the basis of, so to speak, these emerging secondary norms, secondary rules, he calls them. And then having gone on a little further, he says, now, isn't that just what we call a legal system, a legal regime? And he's talking about a counterfactual model as well. And then his hypothesis is that identifies the function of laws perhaps in our actual world. We can see how they would have emerged in that world in order to overcome these problems. That, arguably, is what the function that laws serve actually for us. You know, they enable us to, as it were, control for the beneficial, collectively beneficial norms like truth-telling, like being non-violent, like being non-coercive, like keeping promises, like not stealing if there are property conventions and so on in place. And again, he says robustly likely that a system of law of that kind would emerge. Ergo, what's the function of law? Well, to solve precisely those sorts of problems. I mean, I read the Hart book, I think my first or second year in university, certainly my first year studying philosophy way back.
It took me a long time to read it.
Sorry?
It took me a long time to read Hart, and it was one of these things I was always just seeing cited or referenced as like everyone knows. And yes. I liked it more than I thought I would. I blame you for this, actually. You've kind of sold me on genealogies, which I was initially pretty skeptical on. I think mainly because I don't like Nietzsche. Like, you'd think I would.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, you'd think I would as like a nerdy white guy who thinks he's smarter than he really is. Almost all of us have a Nietzsche phase. And I didn't. Like, I think there's a difference between being deep and obtuse, and I think Nietzsche is often the latter. But I never liked Nietzsche, so I always just, I think, associated genealogies with him and with a sort of slightly overwrought way of thinking. Whereas I think your book, your last one, or your sort of second to last one, where you do the genealogy of moles, but a constructive rather than a debunking genealogy, I think sort of sold me, and this as well, and Hart and so on and so forth, sold me on the idea that it's a way of thinking that can be reasonably straightforward and intuitive to grasp and reasonably parsimonious in how it's argued, which are not qualities I would associate with Nietzsche. But I think I'd been prejudiced on the idea because of him. And no, I'll credit you for this. And I think a lot of your writing pulled me back around. I'm like, okay, no, this is an interesting way to think about foundational practices and concepts.
Well, I found it very useful. I mean, it's both, I found it, I suppose, appealing at a certain motivational level because it challenges your imagination, you know? Mm. And yet it delivers a result that is characteristically philosophical, and yet It isn't pure a priori argument. That's why I stress robustly possible in these counterfactual models. But it also delivers at the same time a fairly clear and analytically clear result. But can I just say about Nietzsche that...
Oh, yeah, go for it.
I know.
Feel free to disagree with my disparaging of the great philosopher. That's the sort of personal...
I come to bury Nietzsche, not to praise him. No. I mean, you ask a question about, do these institutions serve a useful function or not? Okay, let's consider a society without them. And let's think about assuming human beings are as they are with us. Of course, that's a very bold question. And I try to rely on, you know, psychology, what we know in history and so on. As human beings are like us, is there any reason to think that those institutions would have emerged for reasons that were to the benefit of such people? And if there is, then that gives you a hypothesis as to maybe the function that those institutions serve in the actual world. But of course, it's completely open that you might discover, you know, those institutions would not have emerged for the benefit they gave to people in general. But if you assume, as Nietzsche did, that there was a divide between the strong and the weak, an assumption I vehemently reject, then, of course, you are going to be inclined to think, oh, why would morals emerge? After all, they, you know, bind the strong to the same norms as the weak, and as he would see it, have all sorts of disadvantages. And so he's going to say morals would be robustly likely to emerge in such a society in order to serve the purposes of the weak if they could actually get those norms established. So his mode of argument is very similar. It's based on different assumptions about human nature. It ends up saying there is a function to morality, but it's not the sort of function we generally ascribe to morality, first of all. That's why it's debunking. Whereas I think with institutions like law, and I think also morality, it's much more plausible that they would have emerged. And we're not talking about actual human history here. We're talking about a counterfactual model that they would have emerged for the reason of a benefit that they would generally give to at least the relevant people in that society.
Yeah. And I mean, there's sort of two challenges, I think, to Nietzsche, or two things I dislike. One is the foundational assumptions, right? I often feel that a lot of the time, one of the core divides and the core things we're just sort of circling around in political philosophy is what are your foundational assumptions about human nature, right? That's not to say there's not better or worse, but that's, I think, one reason to be suspicious of Nietzsche's account. The other is purely aesthetic, in that I just don't like the way the guy writes. And whereas the genealogies with Hart, with your work, what I like about them is they're quite straightforward to follow in a lot of ways. And I think you could contrast it positively with, to bring in another bit of the history of political thought, with sort of the classic contract theory, you know, Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, in that it just kind of feels like there's, even though they're both just so stories, to use your word, there's a bit more of a suspension of disbelief to go from, like, everyone in the state of nature sits down and consciously agrees to a particular set of ideas. Whereas in the genealogies, it's much more like, this could arise without such an act of coordination. And I think that makes it flow through your head, even if it's not historical and it's a just so story, it makes it flow through your head. Because you say, yeah, I can see that step. Yeah, that probably would happen. Whereas even though they're both ahistorical. The sort of everyone sits down and negotiates a contract is just so manifestly ahistorical. It kind of almost breaks the immersion in the parable, if that makes sense.
Can I make 2 points in response?
Please.
One is, it's important for me in the in the use of the method and in the interpretation of its use by people like Lewis and Hart, that one is arguing that something is robustly possible. Robustly likely, I beg your pardon. That means likely not just because of a fortuity, a lucky accident, as I put it. Now, that already rules out a contract theory. Because to have a contract theory, you have to have this amazingly good fortune that we can put together and make this joint agreement with one another. So this is a story, the genealogical story, is a story of emergence, a robustly likely emergence of these in a non-planned way. And that contrasts directly with any sort of contract theory. Now, it is to Nietzsche's credit, I think, that he wasn't going for a contract theory about morality, that it was a contract among the weak, you know, to pull down the strong. I mean, he's at least suggesting, of course, it's often very, the writing isn't absolutely clear about how it's supposed to have happened, but he's thinking it's a story of emergence. That's one point. So I don't think that a genealogy, as I understand it, is a just so story. Just so stories, it could have happened this way. No,
I was just mirroring your language back to you, but okay.
I think of contract theory as in, it's often at its worst at any rate a just so story. I mean, Hobbes in particular does make some effort to explain how, and there are more things to say about Hobbes, which I'm not going to now. But the other point I wanted to come back to was the assumptions about human nature. I'm in the genealogy work generally, I'm certainly optimistic about human nature, that, you know, people are relatively rational, not entirely, they're relatively self-regarding, but not entirely self-regarding, they're pretty intelligent, you know, they're pretty rational, they may make mistakes time and again, as we know from psychology, but if they're facing the same problem time and time again, and they always suffer because of the action they take, they tend to learn, so to speak, what it's rational to do, i.e. what will not get them into that trouble. So that's fairly optimistic. But in the State book in particular, because the state only emerged historically, as we know, after the agricultural revolution, by different accounts, maybe 1,000 years or so after, but in any case, after that revolution, it's plausible, thinking now counterfactually again, that it's okay that we should think about the people in our model as living in a post-agricultural world where they've learned to raise their crops and domesticate animals, and of course, as a result, developed inequalities of wealth of a kind that we know pretty well were not there prior to the agricultural revolution. So in the book, there's one issue, which is how much equality are you going to assume in your genealogy as between the individuals in this counterfactual model? Now, Hart, I think, actually fails us a bit in assuming that all of the residents of the society, male and female, poor and rich or whatever, are more or less equal in power. And so the benefit to each is what's going to matter equally. I think we can work with a much more realistic, I suppose, assumption and a much less utopian assumption about the degree of equality. And all I actually assume in the book, as you'll know, is that either the society is relatively equal in power, and I often write as if that were the case, but I insist time and again, that's just for convenience. I allow as a possibility that the society we're talking about, maybe already segmented, maybe quite hierarchical, with subgroups, you know, and some groups of gender, ethnicity, or whatever, subject to other groups. And I say, let's think about the most advantaged class. And this almost sounds a bit Nietzschean, doesn't it? I mean, think about those who are in the upper echelon, so to speak. And the assumptions I make to get the genealogy going is that that group in the upper class are large enough, not to be just a single family, let alone a single individual, and they're large enough not to be able just altogether to rule, but also that they're relatively equal to one another in power. There's not so much imbalance of power that one family can dominate others. That's all I assume. And then I argue that on those assumptions, a state would emerge that serves those individuals, call them the citizens, as in the privileged members. And, you know, it might be, I didn't use this analogy in the book, but it might be a group as small as the Norman lords the barons of Norman England in the 12th century. I mean, they were the real citizens, as it were, and they're larger than, they're too large to rule themselves, and under their conventions, the rule is hereditary and so on, by those who do gain power. But they establish terms with King John in 1215 or whatever, the Magna Carta, you know?
Sparta, where the citizen class is like 3% of the population or something
Yes, exactly. I mean, it might be quite small for the genealogy to go through. And what I talk about is, let's suppose it's even as bad as that, that the state is a state with a very small number of its residents as citizens. There are still going to be requirements, so to speak, that there's going to be a story, I would say, about why a state would emerge, something recognizable as a state, even on the basis of such a small, restricted citizenry, so to speak. And there are going to be functional requirements on it as a state, even just those people. And this takes me back to the point that this is a theory of what is functionally required for a state to be successful rather than what's required in justice, because, of course, any theory of justice would say that such a state needs to be enhanced in various ways. Certainly it needs the citizens to be included more fully than in that original case.
One final methodology question. The question could be phrased as a challenge, but it could also be phrased as just a way of digging out what the relationship with sort of real history here, as it were. So I mirrored your language of just so story to mean essentially the claim isn't that this is what actually happened in history, but the claim is still more stronger. It's a stronger claim than is being made in most contract theory, which is more, I mean, in the case of Rawls, self-consciously, just a story. The claim is, even if it didn't happen this way, this is a set of reasons to think it was pretty likely to happen, something towards those lines. But I guess the question then would be, okay, so what would count as falsification of this theory? Because I think the argument people have with contract theory is like, okay, sure, but like, so what? Like, what would disprove that? What would count as like, if I put something, if I imagine an object that if I put it on the table, you would go, yeah, that knocks this all down. What would that object look like, so to speak? Is there such a thing as a historical counterexample that you could give to this, or would it be more like having to show that your assumptions about human nature or reasoning from them are wrong?
Something more like the latter. I mean, obviously, it's only empirical theory that is subject to falsification by empirical evidence. So going back to your first point, the method is not one of telling a story as to how it's very likely actual history was like. You know the old joke, if God hadn't made the railways, we'd have to have invented them, you know, it's not a joke. I mean, the pointing out that there's something really good about the railways, some purpose it serves, such that even if it hadn't come about via God, and that's the joke part, it would have come about by some other way. Now, the idea here is that we just look at a model, it's a counterfactual world, that's why I insist, and if, as were the specifications of the model, are reasonably true to our nature as human beings, and the sorts of conditions under which we exist, and you can argue that in that model it's robustly possible that, likely I should say, that such and such an institution would emerge, then that at least gives you a basis for the hypothesis that's the function of the actual institution. I mean, this is actually long ago, for a long time, of well over 100 years used by economists. Any economist who's asked what is value will tell you, well, imagine a barter society, counterfactual. Imagine a barter society, and then the economist will tell you about the various problems of a barter society. You raise puppies and you want a bit of furniture, but the person who makes furniture doesn't want a puppy. You got to find, you got a real search problem. And then the economist argues that, wouldn't it be very likely, robustly likely, I would say, that one commodity will come to be recognized as something everybody around here wants, you know, like cigarettes in post-World War II Berlin, as the stories all have it. And as soon as that's recognized, well, everybody's going to want, say, cigarettes in order to trade. And at that point, the economist will go and say, that's the rudimentary form of money, the cigarettes in Berlin. And of course, cigarettes at that point, they still have their use value, the pleasure they give to people, but boy, they've gained an exchange value, which is something really in addition. And they've come to be very like money. You know, there was a joke, I understand, in Berlin at the time, which was, everybody wants money, but no one wants to smoke, you know, suggesting the exchange value had just completely wiped out the use value. Now, that story about money is wholly counterfactual. And hence, for example, David Graeber, in a well-known book called Debt, lampoons economists for getting the history wrong, and he's almost certainly right. The book is very impressive. But I don't think the economist should be the slightest bit worried about the fact that actual history wasn't like that. This is just a way of showing there's a benefit served by money, having something that will enable exchange other than by barter. And it turns out we'll serve all sorts of other functions as well, like storing up wealth. You know, you store up the cigarettes in post-World War Berlin, and of course also by putting prices on things. You know, a cup of coffee is worth half a cigarette, you know, a beer is worth a full cigarette or whatever it might be. And it's really it's a heuristic device for generating a plausible theory about the function that money serves, that if we think that is the actual function of money, that may explain why money is so stable, you know, and has been for so long in our societies. Now, similarly,
I find the money one really plausible. Like, it just clicks. And like, yeah, that's not what happened. But like, exactly. It's a very good parable about the usefulness of money. I think it's also backed up to my mind, not because that's how it happened, but money just seems to always happen in any social environment, any culture, continent, age of history. It might not look like a coin, but there's, as soon as you get settled societies, there's something filling that role. Never mind that that's not the story of how we get there. So the money one, to my mind, is really reinforced by its, and it might be like, there's some societies where it was like cattle, which like, doesn't seem terribly portable, but anyway. But it is reinforced by its ubiquity for me. So there is an historical empirical component, I think, to why I find the money one really plausible, is because, yeah, even if it wasn't exactly that way, everyone came up with money, you know?
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's bearing out the point that what you're trying to identify is a function that keeps the institution stable in the actual society. Mm. Once you find that, of course, you now are going to be able to talk about the requirements of that function. What would make the institution functionally better? That's a little bit like now going back to Dworkin. You know, we've identified now the benefits of this institution, assuming it is beneficial that we have a constructive genealogy, not a Nietzschean one. Mm. And the question is there anything that would enhance the discharge of that function that's going to give you functional desiderata on the institution? And then there are going to be also questions about, are there limitations that are imposed on that institution from without? And that's what I do in the book. In the first chapter, I develop a theory about the function of the state, which, you know, as you know very roughly, is to establish a regime of law under which the citizens, and they may be a privileged class, know roughly where they stand against one another and where they stand against those who actually are imposing the law, framing the law and imposing the law. And then I argue in the following chapters that a state that serves that function is going to serve it better if the state is a fully incorporated agent. That's in a way drawing on the work with Christian List. And secondly, and that's in a way intention, as you might say, is still a regime of checks and balances where there isn't just one person or one small group in charge. It'll serve the function better from the point of view of the citizenry. Those are two rival claims. The one suggests that there ought to be a sovereign, as in a group agent, you know, with someone in charge. The other suggests it ought to be, well, in the old phrase, a mixed constitution, a constitution under which power is decentralized, with different centers of power, different channels of power, and so on. And so a great part of the book is showing how those are wholly consistent with one another, which is, of course, contrary to the line in Baudin and Hobbes and Rousseau and all of the absolutist thinkers. And then the remaining part of the book, the second part of the book, looks at, well, are there limitations on the state in virtue of its function? And there I look at three sorts of limitations and I actually argue that no, they're not. So that if you do want to take over the state and argue it should be pursuing these purposes of justice, it's not limited in those ways that I indicate.
So to sort of pick one element of that, what the claim isn't, because I saw someone wrote a criticism of this book saying, oh, Philip Pettit has come up with this idea of the state that sort of requires it to be mixed constitution and so on and so forth. But that's just not a good description, because most states in human history and arguably most today don't look anything, you know, don't have mixed constitutions or democratic input or any of that. That's not quite the claim. It's not like here's an empirical characterization of states as they exist. It's through the genealogy method that we spend some time on, we can think about what the function of a state is, and that function will be better served and better serve the citizenry if the state has these features. It's not a claim that, oh, we can characterize states in the world this way, per se.
Absolutely right, yes. Although, as a matter of fact, actually, I think that on a proper understanding of checks and balances, a mixed constitution, most states do have a mixed constitution, but, you know, I don't want to go into that particularly. But, for example, in the book, when talking about, you know, checks and balances regimes, I contrast the American presidential system and parliamentary systems like Britain has, for example, or Australia has, or Canada, or New Zealand, or whatever. And parliamentary systems do have a mixed constitution insofar as the courts are independent. That means there are two bodies that have to interact with one another in determining what the law is. That is to say, the law that's laid down on people, because the legislature may propose a law, but if there's a constitution in existence, ideally established by the people, but there's going to be some, if there's any sort of framework of operation that allows the courts to strike down some proposed laws as being unconstitutional, then that's immediately a mixed constitution, even though there isn't as much mixture, as I call it. There aren't as many checks and balances as there are in the American system. Although in the parliamentary system, I hasten to add, I think there are many checks and balances that there ought to be in the American system. So, for example, one aspect of checks and balances, say, I know Australia quite well, it's where I spent half my year, and where I'm a citizen and so on, or in Ireland, where I'm also a citizen, where I was born and raised. And in both of those countries, there's an independent electoral commission. So, for example, the electoral commission in Australia dictates the district and redistricting that's required and regulates the rules and so on. And they really have an independent authority. They're appointed by the elected government, but the elected government daren't really and don't ever challenge the electoral commission, except in very gentle criticism, so to speak, because people in general invest trust in it. And those who are appointed under conditions of transparency. They're constrained in various ways. They're given desiderata to operate by. That's an independent, now it's at arm's length, it's not entirely independent, but it's relatively independent from those in the legislature or the executive, for example. And that's a check, a really important check. And of course, you don't have that check in America in many places. As we know, the local state legislature in parts of America just simply determines the districts. And of course, notoriously, the state legislature determines the districts in a way that favors the particular party that has control of that state legislature, which is truly an abuse of democracy of the most awful kind.
Yeah. I could talk about gerrymandering, but that's probably beside our conversation to go into the intricacies of how congressional districts get drawn. It is a very, very, very serious challenge to the American democratic process. To close, I mean, I guess the sort of, to push the challenge a bit, though, that we're still within the realm of democracies here. Like, a lot of states are starkly authoritarian. And, you know, I guess you could say even within authoritarian regimes, there's, like, different moving parts and power centres. But that's further down the spectrum, right?
Yes. Yes, I agree. Well, remember when I said the function of the state is to establish a regime of law that enables the citizens to know where they stand in relation to another in the state. Now, consistently with that, of course, the state might, you know, do that job from the point of view of its citizens, but still fail, for example, to it might fail to be incorporated fully as an agent, a group agent, insofar as, for example, some elements within the system were capable of going rogue, like the police, for example, or the military, for that matter. That would be a failure. And that's true in many states, as we unfortunately know today. But on the checks and balances side, equally, the state need not have checks and balances and yet satisfy that function. It's just it won't satisfy it as well. That's what I argued from the point of view of the citizens, regardless of how few the citizens are. Of course, I should say also that it's completely consistent with the argument of the book that you might regard some regimes in existence today as not deserving of the name of states, as not being even functional states. Perhaps citing examples is always a problem, because you'll get. But in any case, let me step out of line. North Korea strikes, from what I know of it, strikes me as not a proper state. Even Rousseau, of course, also Kant, also everybody, even Hobbes said that, say in Rousseau's words, the subjugation of the multitude does not mean that you have a state. A state does not just mean there's one person in power and bang, you know, they're totally in control of all the people who live under them. In order to be a state, and I absolutely agree, it has to be a form of power that would mean that there are laws set down and that the government operates by those laws, roughly speaking. But that's quite consistent with, for example, the emergence of, an autocratic democracy, you know, whereby you've got elections every 5 years, which of course can get to be rigged anyhow, where there aren't independent courts, where there isn't an election of a really fair and equal sort, where there aren't any possibilities of pushback by the citizenry, you know. Now, that's a world in which there is a system of law. It's functional in a basic sense. It's not just a subjugation of the multitude. It's not just North Korea, and I may be doing North Korea a disservice, but it's certainly not a just state, and it's not even a fully functional state. It's a functional state, but it isn't an ideally functional state. There are desiderata on being a functional state that it is not satisfying.
And so to just like, I guess you could, here's one, you could do it from the analogy with money as well to really get down the distinction between a descriptive claim and the argument from sort of what its function is you say, well, the function of money is to serve as a medium of exchange. There are various systems in which that is done less well, and even so badly to the point where it's just not fulfilling that function at all. So you might consider a case of hyperinflation where your money's worth 10 times as much at the end of the day as it was at the beginning. Well, it's still money in a sense, but it's clearly failing what we would identify the function of money to be, in that if the price is that unstable, it's not a very good medium of exchange. And indeed, people talk about it this way. When you get inflationary spirals, people say this isn't real money. It's just bits of paper. They even use the language of it not being real, even though descriptively, presumably, it is still money in some sense. And then you could just say the same thing's true of the state. If we're going to do a descriptive of the things we call states, it includes a whole range, but some of them are failing that function, and some so profoundly that we might even sort of say, as people say, well, this isn't real money, this is not worth anything. You might sort of say, well, North Korea, it's not even a real state, it's sort of how would you describe it? It's just sort of gangster rule. Technically, someone came up with the name for North Korea of a morsellocracy because it's technically, its head of state is a dead man, Kim Il-sung.
I see, yes.
A necrocracy. But anyway, you could say, so when you get something that weird and perverse, it's just not, if I understand your argument, it's not even really, it's so far from the function that you might say.
I like your analogy with money a lot, you know, and even if, you know, you're talking about inflation as fiat money, which is all we have basically nowadays, just think of an economy with metallic money, you know, be silver or gold or whatever. If the gold is running out or running short, you know, it begins to not be very good at serving the function. Or think of if cigarettes were the only exchange sort of commodity, the only money, I mean, that would not be a very good, because, you know, they break up and so on. Or, you know, think of a world where cattle are money, as in effect that has been historically the case in older societies. They're not very good because you can't carry them around in your pocket, for example, you know. So something can serve a function that explains why that institution is important and likely to be stable without serving it very well, that's for sure.
Final, we've just crossed the hour mark and I did promise to limit to an hour. Final question then, because I like the analogy with money, I think you do too. Do you see the state as robustly emergent as money is? Because like I say, the money one clicks for me because it's money's so ubiquitous. Like the state, I wonder sometimes if we can sort of simplify a little and say humans come together and live in large numbers, complicated stuff happens, and then we end up with states as the norm, right? I do sometimes wonder if there's something in the middle of that complicated stuff that might have gone off on a bit of a different trajectory. Because there's definitely a thing with states where once other people start doing it, you kind of have to start doing it, right? Yes. But I wonder if you could develop a sort of counterfactual history where other people didn't start doing it and it doesn't become the norm. Let me give you a very quick example, but like, I've been in the ancient Near East, yeah, physically, literally, but no, I've been reading about the ancient Near East a bit recently, and I'm sort of struck by different models of empire and rule. So like, the Persian Empire isn't really a state as we would think about it. It's a central authority that demands tribute, stops people rebelling, and keeps out internal threats. But all of the administration of norms and laws is delegated, essentially, if more than just federalism, like everything, like, and they make a virtue out of it. They say, you, ancient Israel, you can have your own constitution, your own laws, your own kings. We're not even a backup enforcer of that, do you? Just pay your tribute. And that's pretty alien to us. In the, I think in the West, we really think about empire and statehood through Rome, right? Where if you're under Roman Imperium, you're subject to Roman law, and the functions of security and law and norm enforcement are all much more neatly aligned, right? But say we live in an alternate history where Alexander the Great just catches an arrow to the face in the Battle of the Granicus, Persian Empire doesn't fall, and instead of Roman law, Persian, just say, becomes the dominant colonial force around the world, or the dominant export. And actually, you don't end up with the nation state as the dominant form. You end up with a patchwork of sort of local norm enforcement, local particular constitutions, or just like pure local conventions. I think through a lot of ancient history, it was much more the village elder relying on like charismatic authority, right? Secured by maybe a few global powers that solve the security question, but not the norm question, that those two things don't get aligned in the way they do in our world. I don't know. I mean, you never know with counterfactuals, right? You just, there's no way you can run that experiment. But I do sometimes, I do wonder, do we sort of take the fact that we've ended up with nation states now and project that backwards? Or is there some other world where, like, the foundational models we have of it just take us on a very different path? I don't quite see what that different path is with money, but I can come up with stories of what it might be with states. That was quite long, so I'll pause there.
Well, there's one big difference between money and states in this context. At least if the genealogy I offer is correct, or say the genealogy Hart offers is correct, then you'd expect among a community of people who are not surrounded by other peoples that are competitively related to it, maybe they live in an island or whatever, you'd expect that a state law and a state would emerge there as well on the basis of this argument. But I think in the actual world, and I do allow for this within the model, there are very likely to be other communities that have similar developments, develop a system of law, a system of states. And then, of course, there's always the possibility of the likelihood of conflict between them. Mm. And that, I think, increases the robust likelihood of the development of states. Mm. You know, as Charles Tilly, I think, once said, the state made war and war made the state. You know, as in, once states start war with one another, then that increases the need for each to organize itself as a state.
Mm.
Okay. That's the first point to make. I don't think that disturbs in itself the genealogy. But the other point to make is that, of course, what is possible, even in the counterfactual model, is that one of these states will prove so powerful in relation to the other states that it can exact tribute from them, you know, while allowing them in a basic way to remain as state-like, as it were. And that, of course, is empire, you know, where you get one state colonizing other states. I mean, in the sense at least of maybe allowing them a lot of autonomy, but demanding tribute, for example. And that's clearly what happened in the Persian case. And I think what has happened in the case of many empires. But all of that is quite consistent with the story. What it means is, in a way, in the model, what you're doing is you're introducing now a darker element, you know. If it's the case that one of these states has enormous power, you know, say because of having much richer land or whatever it might be, or having, you know, being better at war, like, for example, Genghis Khan has said, you know, it was the small ponies on the steppes, you know, that allowed the Mongols, you know, to invade China and then later the whole tracts of Eurasia. I mean, that's a possibility, and it did historically happen. But it's not going to be relevant if you're considering in a counterfactual model what the ideal form, functional form of a state is going to be. So, yeah.
No, yeah, I'm just, I guess, struck by how different forms of empire and imperium can be in terms of the extent to which those forms of imperium are top-down enforcing norms and rules from the case of Rome on one end, which it's definitely doing, to the case of, say, Persia, where it's not doing it at all. But I guess your argument would be, fine, that's historically interesting, and maybe we do end up in a world that's modelled on Persia instead of Rome, but it's still a state in some sense. It might be states subjugated to the Persian state, whereas the Rome is more like one super state, but it's still, you can trace out the characteristics of what you're describing in there somewhere, albeit in a sort of different form.
Yes, I mean, you see, we were moving very quickly.
Sorry, that was just a question.
Theory of justice, you know. So, for example, you know, as you know, I identify with neo-republican sort of thinking, which would certainly argue that within the state, you know, citizens should enjoy a very rich set of rights against one another and powers against one another, so that they, the law should enable them to know where they stand vis-a-vis one another and vis-a-vis private corporations and so on, in a very rich way. I mean, I have a test of that, the so-called eyeball test, that people be able to look one another in the eye without reason for fear of deference. And I think they just state equally, the government ruling over it, people would know where they stand in relation to it, again, in a very rich sense, not just in the austere, minimal, functional sense. They would have each equal access to a system of control, which may be electoral, contestatory, you know, have many, many wings that effectively constrains those in power so that they can't just act on their own will. But of course, that way of thinking also extends to the relationship between states. So, for example, I think in your theory of justice, you're bound to have an account, and I sort of subscribe to a insufficiently detailed but still outline account. Many other people have argued for a neo-republican view of the relationship between states, under which one state should not have dominate another state, should not have a power of interfering in it asymmetrically. And of course, that's breached by empire. Now, this story about the functional character of the state is focusing on the domestic only, and the state functionally should be acting in relation to its citizens. That theory is meant to be abstracting from international relations. That really belongs, I think, in the realm of the theory of justice, normative theory. And, you know, as I say in the book, the state book is meant to be followed up by another book, probably to be called From State to Republic, which would take the theory of the state in this book and look at what a neo-republican theory of justice would require that state to be, the actual desiderata required to satisfy. And that will equally lead on to a theory of how states should relate to one another in order to achieve global justice.
So that would be your law of peoples, as it were, when you get through to...
That would seem to be, I mean, I think, of course, that's where a republican law of peoples.
Yeah. Okay. We just ran over an hour, so should we pause there? The book is The State by Philip Pettit with Princeton, right? Yeah, Princeton University Press. Thanks so much for coming on. I always appreciate your time.
A pleasure, as always, to be interviewed by you, Toby. Thank you.